Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad to be here. The opening drive is Luke chapter 12. Again, we continue with our study of the life of Christ. It's important, I think, as we go on to this next section, to remember at the beginning of this chapter, what's the situation? Again, what type of audience? Small, big? A big audience, a large multitude. Again, thousands of people, so much so that they're stepping on each other. And again, he initially warns them about, interestingly enough, again, large audience, not a pep talk, but you got to be careful about hypocrisy. And again, everything that's happening, that you're doing, that you don't think anybody knows about, it's going to come out. Warning everybody about that, and warning again that hypocrisy will spread. And we got to be careful about, we talk about that. And we talk about confession and denial, about what that means. And then we're in the context of verses 13 through the remainder of the chapter. And he's now going to go into a series of parables. So we're going to talk more, recap a little bit about parables. But it's in this context, again, of having a large multitude before him. And we're going to talk about why he spoke in parables. And the fact is, did everybody get the point of the parables? Did they understand? No. And we're going to talk about why. But again, it's in this context of a large multitude, many people stepping on each other. Again, it makes me think of Luke chapter 14, where he again has a large multitude, and he's challenging them about who cannot be his disciple. But here again, it's going to involve their attitude about the kingdom, and he's challenging them, he's challenging us regarding these things as well. So we'll begin our study there in Luke chapter 12. All right, Luke chapter 12, and I guess I'm going to read verses 13 through 21, again, as we set the context for our study tonight. Luke 13, thank you, Jim, verses 13 through 21.
Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentiful. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God.'"
All right, thank you, Jim. So again, we're talking about parables. We introduced last week the idea that, again, parables are simply stories that define the unknown by that which is known. We need to appreciate this aspect. There is a challenge in every parable. And again, the challenge needs to be taken personally, that we apply that. We need to also understand, again, is there anything wrong with, as we preach and teach today, to use examples from our own lives to help illustrate biblical truth? No. We need to be careful about those. But what we need to appreciate about parables is, again, who came up with these parables? I'm sorry?
The Lord did.
So again, these are divinely inspired parables. And we need to appreciate that there is divine truth in these parables. They're, you know, sometimes you ever heard somebody give a story as an example, and you're like, "I don't get it." You know, and you're like, that seems to kind of miss the point. Again, these are parables from God. And we need to appreciate the inspiration of these parables and the truth that they have. And one thing I kind of left out last week that I've always heard as far as like a definition of parable is, it's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Again, and that's that aspect of again, the train tracks. Again, it's the idea that, again, the earthly story, it's the sower, it's the fig tree, it's whatever that is. And again, we're to go over and make the heavenly meaning. So we're to go from the fleshly to the spiritual. And so that's, again, jumping from the one track to the other, from the familiar to the unfamiliar. Again, we made the point last week, when we get into these parables and we start talking about, again, the sower and the fig tree and the mustard seed and all these things, there can be a temptation to stay there in the fleshly part of it, to say just, you know, we're so curious about the idea of the fig tree and to learn everything about the physical side of this, and then we never again, as it were, jump to the parallel. That is the spiritual truth. And we made the example that I always use is, again, from the Old Testament. What was the example we used last week from the Old Testament? Not defined as a parable, but in actuality it was. Nathan to David, remember? Again, Nathan gave the parable about the man who had the one little ewe lamb and so forth. And he explained that. And we made the point how that, again, David stayed on the one side of the track. He was outraged. And he said, he stayed in the story. He said, that man, again, he should be put to death. And again, finally, Nathan then said to him, you're the man. And again, he forced David to, again, go from the physical example to, oh yeah, there's some application, there's some truth, and I need to apply that in my life. So we need to apply it to ourselves, and we need to go beyond simply a literal meaning and actually make application of these parables. So Jesus, again, taught in parables, and in teaching parables, we made this point at the end of class, there's kind of two dangers. One, kind of like we said with David, we miss the main point, okay? This, you know, that parable, as it were, that Nathan gave to David, David got the story, but in terms of the application, went right over his head, in terms of applying it to himself. And we can, again, miss the main point of these parables. What is Jesus, what is God trying to teach us? And that main point, we can miss it. And we can miss it in terms of our self-application. But the other danger, again, is getting tied up in the details of saying, okay, we're going to talk about the parable of the sower, and one of the types of soil has the weeds that grow up. And so let's define the types of weeds, and the thistles represent, no. You know, again, you see how we can get lost in details and try to make meaning where there isn't. And so we need to understand, don't miss the point, but let's not get caught up in trying to, again, equate the types of weeds to different types of sins in our life or something like that. We need to appreciate the point of what the thorns and thistles that they do represent. It's interesting to note that there was a 4th century preacher who, speaking about parables, says, I'm always saying that the parables must not be explained throughout word for word, since many absurdities will follow. And again, we need to understand the words that are used, and we need to define those. But again, the point being is, and I've heard this before, take these parables to an absurd point. And we do it, by doing that, we've missed the main point. We've missed the lesson that Jesus is trying to teach. So now here in Luke chapter 12, beginning verse 13, again, he gives us this parable of what is called commonly the rich fool in verses 13 through 21. In Matthew chapter 13, in the next, as we're going to progress beyond this, if you can go to Matthew chapter 13, what does it say in verse 3 regarding his use of parables?
And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, the sower went out to sow.
All right, many things. So again, this was a frequent tool of his. And if you'll drop down to verse 10 of Matthew chapter 13, David, if you go ahead and read Matthew chapter 13, verse 10 through 15.
Okay. It says, and the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? Jesus answered them, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore, I speak to them in parables, because while seeing they do not see, and while hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, "You will keep on hearing, but you will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not perceive. For the heart of the people has become dull. With their ears, they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise, they would see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their heart, and return, and I would heal them."
All right, so we're going to talk about the last four verses of that context in just a bit. But the first point in verse 10, the question was raised to Jesus, why are you telling these stories? What's the point? Why are you doing this? If I can get someone to read Psalms chapter 78, verses 1 through 4. You know, part of the reason Jesus spoke in parables was it was basically a fulfillment of prophecy. Richard, do you have that?
Psalm 78, 1 through 4. "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of Jehovah and his strength and his wondrous works that he hath done."
What does this teach us about our responsibility with these parables?
Teach them.
Yes, use them. And it starts where?
With the children.
At home, yeah, with your family. Use these parables to teach. So again, prophetically, it was talking about the fact that in the time of the kingdom, the Messiah would use parables. And these parables were meant to be repeated, to use them. And we know that as we teach children learn by stories. And so again, it's a great tool to use with our families. But we need to use these parables. They need to be taught to tell the generation to come the praises of his Lord and his strength and his wondrous works that he has done. So again, we need to appreciate why he spoke in parables. And let's go back to the context of Matthew chapter 13 when he was asked, "Well, why are you doing this?" And it's interesting, why didn't Jesus, again, just go around and say, here's my 20 commands, okay? Just make sure you do these 20 things. Why tell stories? Why tell a parable that, again, you have to, as the disciples came to him with the parable of the sower, said, "Can you explain it to us?" Why would he do that? Let's look at Matthew 13 as it's been read. And let's begin in verses 11 and 12 when he says, "To you it has been granted to know what?" The mysteries of the... Again, there are mysteries of the kingdom that I want to teach you. Now, again, if we're simply giving facts, is that going to perhaps give us the insight that we need to into the kingdom? The kingdom that, again, had been a mystery. And beyond that, he said, "But to them it has not been granted. Whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away." I just wanted to focus on that word in verse 12. Does God want us to know just a little bit about the kingdom? He wants us to, again, have an abundance of knowledge. And again, are there truths, spiritual truths about the kingdom of God that we can learn from these parables that will help us in our understanding of the kingdom and our role within it? Yeah, absolutely. So I think two things there in terms of why would he teach in parables. One, again, it's about giving insight into the mysteries of the kingdom. Number two is so that our knowledge of it will grow and that we'll know more and more about it. That aspect of the mysteries was something that, again, the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter spoke of in terms of the mysteries of the kingdom in Romans chapter 16 and verse 25. Paul said, "Now to him who is able to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ according to the revelation of the mystery which has been kept secret for long ages past, but now is manifested and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the eternal God, has been made known to all the nations, leading to the obedience of faith. Again, the mystery, the revealing, that which was not known is now known. 1 Corinthians 4:1 says, Paul said, let a man consider us.
You know, out of us,
yeah,
as of ministers of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God.
Stewards of the mystery. Yeah, we're servants, ministers, and we're stewards of the mysteries of God. Again, it's those mysteries that, again, Jesus is trying to teach us about. The mysteries that in Ephesians chapter 1, Paul is talking about that have been planned from times eternal, beginning in verse 7 of Ephesians 1. And in Him, in Christ, we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of His grace, which He lavished on us. In all wisdom and insight, He made known to us the mystery of His will according to His kind intention, which He purposed in Him. So again, this idea that the mystery of the kingdom, Jesus came to reveal that, and He used parables to accomplish that purpose. But then going on, again, why speak in parables? Look at verses 13 through 15 of Matthew chapter 13, where He said, therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing they do not see, and while hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on hearing, but will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not perceive. But the heart of this people has become dull. With their ears they scarcely hear, and they've closed their eyes. Otherwise they would see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I would heal them. What is Jesus, in using parables, trying to accomplish? What does He want to have happen? He wants us to understand. He wants us to get it, that we would see, that we would hear, that we would understand, that we would perceive. Is he trying to conceal truth? He actually wants us to see, to hear, to understand, perceive, to get it. It's interesting, the word understand that's used here in verse 14 comes from a Greek word meaning to put together mentally, to comprehend. Again, you ever had a course in college or high school where you struggled? I mean, I'm just not getting it. And then finally, the professor, the teacher might use, let me give an illustration. And he uses a story, something like that. And all of a sudden you go, okay, I now made the mental connection. You know that feeling where something finally clicked up here and you say, I got it. Okay? Something clicked. Something came together in your mind. And what was, again, you know, not connecting before, now, okay, that little neuron is connecting. But that's what this idea of understanding is. And again, you go back to the idea of the train tracks. He spoke these so that, again, we would get it. So that we would make that connection. That it would come together. It would be put together and we'd be able to comprehend. And again, it's the same word that's used in Luke chapter 24, verse 45. Where again, after His resurrection, that He explained the law and the prophets to His apostles, and it says there in verse 45 that so they understood.
The scriptures.
They understood. Yeah, they understood. Right, the scriptures. Then He opened their minds to understand the scriptures. Again, it was for the disciples an aha moment. Okay, I get it. You were saying all these things during your ministry. Now you've explained them to us, and I get it. It came together in their minds, and they were able to understand it. Ephesians chapter 5, in verse 17, that same word is used in that passage. Do you have that, Richard?
Wherefore, be not foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is.
Okay. Yeah, you know, the foolish never works to make that connection in their head. They never bring the scriptures together. Again, going back to, not to, trying to overly hype the Tuesday morning class, but it's about taking the whole Word of God to be able to understand the Old Testament and the New Testament, how it fits together, how the prophecies fit together. Again, as we talked about, like in Acts chapter 8, about the Ethiopian eunuch, to be able to take somebody from Isaiah 53 and, again, bring it all together. So that, again, it clicks in their mind. So they can look, I get it. I see God's scheme, his plan to redeem us and the prophecies, how it was fulfilled. I get it now. But that takes work.
No, no. We were discussing with Leonardo last week about his comment about how could these people, essentially, to really basically paraphrase him, be so dense that they could not understand. So the scribes and Pharisees didn't understand, the Sadducees, all these people, Saul of Tarsus didn't understand. I think it has to do with the fact that they can't understand that it's that simple. I think they think that it has to be more complex. And that's why, as far as the Jews went, they had the teachings of the rabbis and all those other extra-biblical teachings. And they felt that those, which were much more complex, were superior to the scriptures themselves because the scriptures were too simple to be true.
Yeah. Plus, along with that point, again, it's the wisdom of the world versus the wisdom of God, right? The wisdom of the world is very complicated. I mean, it's very in-depth. The wisdom of God is simple. But if I get someone, I'll use this passage later, but I'm going to use it now. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, beginning in verse 14 through chapter 3, verse 3. 2:14 through 3:3. Thank you, Jimmy.
The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them, because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual person judges all things, but is himself to be judged by no one. For who has understood the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. But I, brothers, could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for it, and even now you are not yet ready, for you are still of the flesh. For while there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way?
Verse 14, the very first verse, what did it say about some people and understanding? There are some people who cannot understand. Because it says the natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God. They're foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them. Why?
He's not speaking spiritually.
Again, yeah, he's carnally minded. He's thinking about things temporally. Everything is fleshly. It's about the here and the now, and you're presenting me with spiritual truths from a parable? Again, you cannot connect, you cannot bring those things together, spiritual truths and the fleshly mindset. That's why, again, not only, again, is it so simple, but again, when you have that fleshly mindset, you're thinking like, again, mere men. We're thinking like animals. We're thinking like just creatures here on earth. And we're being presented with eternal spiritual truths, and we're like, I don't get it. And again, Paul says, when you're walking and thinking like a mere man, you're not going to understand. You're not going to be able to get that. And again, in verse 3 of chapter 3, again, are you not walking like mere men? Are you thinking like mere men? And if that's the case, again, the parables as they were presented to people, the Pharisees who were walking according to the flesh, walking like mere men, they weren't going to get it because, again, their mindset was somewhere else. And, again, the simplicity of the message. So, again, why did he speak to them in parables? Well, it's going to, again, differentiate between those who have a spiritual appetite versus those who are, again, walking like mere men. And so we need to make sure that our focus is on the things that are above, that we're thinking spiritually. Now, this particular parable, let's go back to Luke chapter 12. Any other thoughts, though, in terms of, again, why Jesus spoke in parables and why some people wouldn't get it? All right. Back in Luke chapter 12. Again, we had just finished talking about the fact that, again, remember Jesus had told his disciples, when they drag you before the rulers and authorities, don't worry about what you're going to say. Holy Spirit will be with you. And again, remember, go back to verse 1. It's a multitude. They're stepping on each other. It's a large crowd. And somewhere in this large crowd, this mass of people, And again, what types of things has Jesus been talking about in verses 1 through 12? He's been talking about such spiritual matters as hypocrisy, right? I'm sorry?
And those that kill the body, fearing those that kill the body.
Yes. Don't worry about, again, temporal matters. Don't worry about fearing God. You know, don't worry about fearing men. You should fear God and worry about the judgment. That's heavy matters, aren't they? Spiritual matters. Trying to get their mind set on the things above. Worrying about hypocrisy. Worrying about judgment. About confession and denial. Remember, are we going to confess Jesus, that He is the Son of God? Important spiritual truths. And in this spiritual context, hypocrisy, confession. Again, not worrying about physical things, but spiritual. Someone in the crowd says what?
Off the wall. Did my people divide, my father divide the inheritance with me?
Yeah, Jesus, I know you're talking about judgment and hypocrisy and these spiritual truths, but you know what? My parents just died and I want half my inheritance. You see the really? And so he interrupts the Lord with concern about what? My fair share. I want what's fair. I want what's coming to me. Again, we just talked about spiritual truths. Where is this person's mindset? It's temporal. The things of this life. And he says to Jesus, I want people to be fair with me. I want my life to be fair. Are we looking to Jesus to make things fair? Is that, Lord, this is what I want you for. I want you to make things fair in life. I want to make sure that I get all that's coming to me. And we all know from a spiritual point of view, do we want that? It's kind of the old question, be careful what you ask for. Do you really want fair and just? Do we really want what's coming to us? If we're honest, we don't. But this man, again, that's what he viewed Jesus as for. You're going to, again, you know, you're going to balance the scales. You know, that when there's, you're going to be like Moses in the wilderness when he had to sit and judge between disputes between men. You're going to settle all these temporal matters. And what did Jesus have to say to this man who interrupted him during his preaching and teaching?
Am I your divider?
It's a pretty strong rebuke, isn't it? He said to him, man who appointed me a judge or an arbiter over you. And by using the term man, what is he emphasizing? Again, going back to 1 Corinthians 2, 14 through 33. You're looking at life from a temporal perspective. You're just a man. You're thinking about things physically. And he rebuked him for thinking that it was under his purview that Jesus would determine the equitable distribution of wealth. That's why Jesus came, isn't it? That's why he left the throne of God, so he'd come down and make sure that one got his fair share. But again, are there those who teach and preach yet today that that's what religion is all about? To make sure you get all yours. You know, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but it's the gospel of health and wealth. As if you can look that term up on the internet. That's what some people preach. The gospel of health and wealth. Make sure you get yours. That's what Jesus is all about, making sure you get your blessings. And not the spiritual blessings, Paul says in Ephesians 1:3. So we need to be careful. And again, he said to him, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter over you? Is that why I'm here? I'm going to settle these civil lawsuits. I'm going to settle these family squabbles. He then said in verse 15, what? What's the first word?
Beware.
Take heed or beware. Watch out, beware, and
be on your guard.
Against what?
Covetousness.
Every form of covetousness. In every manifestation. Again, beware means to, again, wait, I know what that word means. Again, it means to look out for with the eyes. It means, again, that it's the old, I'm watching for that. I have my eye on that attitude, on that heart, and that mindset. Again, we say, I'm watching. Are we watching for that heart that says, I'm going to make sure I get all of mine? And again, he says, be on your guard. That has more of, again, it's not only I'm watching, but I set up my defenses. I have things in place in my life to make sure that doesn't come in. And, you know, again, from if you're building a castle, again, and you're going to get to be on your guard, you know, you then build your wall, you have your moat, you have your guard set up to keep things out. And again, so he says, not only do you look for it in terms of, again, it trying to come in, but you have your defenses set up so that, again, when you see that potential greed coming, I have something in place. I have something. So literally, to watch out and to guard. Again, it's that idea, I'm up on my watchtower, I'm looking for it, but I have something in place. My front door is not open. Okay, there's a guard in place to prevent it from happening. But a few things to note about this situation. Number one, the one who brought up this matter before Jesus, did he ask Jesus, Lord, give me all the inheritance? Again, we might say he was just asking for his share. Isn't that right? Wouldn't you say he has a good case from a legal perspective? I just want, again, my fair share. But greed can manifest itself in many forms and in many ways. And sometimes greed is simply wanting what we think is ours. Sometimes we think greed is just when we want more than ours. More than my share. That's greed. This guy just wanted his share. But again, Jesus said, you got to be careful about greed. Because it comes in various ways. We have to watch out for that mindset of, again, I just want mine. And number three to note, at the heart of greed and covetousness is what? Did this man who wanted his fair share, was he dying? Did he not have enough to eat? It's not a matter of, at the heart of greed is a lack of contentment. Again, we look at passages such as Philippians 4:11, which, to me, I love that passage because Paul said what about his attitude about contentment? Paul said, I've learned. Again, contentment is not a natural attribute. It's something we have to learn to say, okay, look at my situation. This man who interrupted Jesus needed to stop and say, look, I'm content. I'm okay. I have what I need. And we need to appreciate the need to learn contentment. But also, what do we learn from Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5? Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. So again, this idea of we need to remember that when we have this attitude of I want what's mine, again, we've set up that idol in our hearts where that getting my fair share now has become the idol that I serve. That's what I'm aiming towards. And so we need to remember that greed, again, is a form of idolatry. It's, again, in greed, even in the terms of just wanting what's mine.
With that, I mean, in talking about how he's not saying, you know, tell my brother give me everything, but that what Jesus is offering is, like, so much better than anything he could have gotten from it. So, I mean, like, that contrast there is just amazing, that what Jesus is offering up and this, what this guy thinks is important.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's Again, it makes me think, Juan, of that conversation with the Samaritan woman. And the water, and he said, I've got something so much better than that water. This type of water, you'll never thirst again. It'll give the type of riches that Jesus has to offer, you're right, are so much better than what he's trying to squabble with his brother about. You don't need to worry about that. Because you have, there is something grander in heaven. That even if you, again, your brother does take everything, you're okay. You've got something greater ahead of you. Great point. Anybody ever go to the doctor and get diagnosed with pleonexia? Sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? That's the Greek word for greed. I just thought, it sounds like a disease, doesn't it? And I look at the pleonexia, I mean, it's like, ooh, that sounds serious. It is serious, isn't it? It's a Greek word which simply means the greedy desire to have. That's the word, the base word pleon. And echo is the second part of the word, which simply means more. The greedy desire to have more. Again, it doesn't matter whether the desire to have more, we think it's just our fair share. Again, he just wanted more. One commentator said the ever-present desire, that aspect, it's an ongoing thing. Again, it's just, when I've got, if he had gotten his fair share, what would be the next step? Well, there had been some other point in his life in which that would not be enough. There's got to be more. There's got to be more. And it is a serious disease, isn't it? It's something we have to be very careful about. Psalms 119, if I can get somebody to read verses 36 and 37. I'll just read the whole chapter. Go ahead, Richard.
36 and 37. Incline my heart unto thy testimonies, and not to covetousness. Turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity, and quicken me in thy ways.
If you begin to have that case of pleonexia, and you feel an onset of it, these two verses, how do you overcome that feeling, that pleonexia coming on you? First verse.
Look at his word.
Yeah.
My heart for his testimonies.
Oh, I mean, won't that ground you in terms of what you're talking about, thinking about how much more God has to offer? Where are you going to read about that? Again, go back to his word that tells you all that he has to offer you. Go back and think about the riches and treasures of heaven, about how that, again, everything's beyond this life. When you begin to have that feeling of pleonexia, covetousness, that desire to have more and more, stop. Again, use his word as that grounding tool to anchor you, you know, bring you back. Okay, I'm seeing all my neighbors with their new cars and new houses and the things of this life, and I have that feeling of I want my fair share. Again, go back. Let the word of God ground you in terms of the things that you need to remember. But it's interesting, again, can there simply be a moment of temptation with pleonexia? Can we have those individual moments? Yes. But for most, pleonexia is what? A momentary thing? It's a way of life, isn't it? It's how we look at life. It's an attitude, approach towards life. It's not just a momentary thing. What did Jesus say back in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15 in this account? In verse 15, when he says, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, pleonexia, he says, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. This is what Jesus is talking about, again, is not just a momentary slip-up. It's a way of life. It's our approach towards how we live and how we think. What is our life going to consist of? What's going to be the substance of our life? So, again, I think it's important as we think about greed and our attitude towards things that we understand it's, okay, I need to get over it now. I need to change my thinking now. but I've got to change it perpetually. It's got to be a focus of mindset on how we, again, what is going to define my life? What's my life going to consist of? Because when you have pleonexia, as we said, it's an ongoing thing, isn't it? Whatever, when you have that disease, whatever status you're at in terms of the things of this life, the disease causes you to what? Is there ever a point with you, when you have that disease, that you go, okay, I'm here now. I've arrived. And in fact, in this parable that follows, Jesus illustrates someone who believes that at some point in time, I will get to that point where my pleonexia will no longer affect me. But it's not true. What does our life consist of? He uses, again, the phrase, not even when one has an abundance. Just an interesting term. That word means the fragments that's left over after all have been fed. You know, that reference in Luke chapter 9, you know, verse 17, what the context of that is? You can probably guess about the fragments that were picked up after everybody's been fed. Yeah, it's the term for what was gathered up after everybody had been fed. That's the same term. And Jesus said, not even when you have more than, when stuff's falling off your plate, you have more than what you need. You would think at that point in time, you'd say, okay, everything's good. But he goes, your life doesn't even when you get to that point, that's not it. But it's interesting, this word, and we need to, I want to appreciate this point. It struck me. When talking about having things in abundance, again, the world lives by saying more stuff in your garage. But the Bible talks about the fact that Christians should have an approach towards abundance. But what should we be abounding in? 1 Corinthians 15:58, that same word is used, but Paul says we should abound what? 1 Corinthians 15. Always abounding in the work of the Lord. Our abundance is not in physical things. But you can look up that term, that Greek word, and again, the vast majority of it is used towards spiritual things that we're to abound in. The Word of God, abounding in prayer, abounding in the work of the Lord. And so again, abounding is a spiritual thing, but we need to keep it towards spiritual matters. Now, the question is, what do we do when we are blessed with an abundance of this world's goods? Just in summary, what does 1 Timothy chapter 6, what does Paul tell Timothy about those who have more than what they need? What are they to do with it? Let's go ahead and read verses 6 through 10 and 17 through 19. Jim, do you have that?
Timothy 6.
1 Timothy 6.
6 through 10.
Yeah.
Now there is a great gain in godliness with contentment, for we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs.
And then verse 17 through 19.
As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good and to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasures for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life.
All right, so especially those last three verses, if we have more than what we need, Paul's instruction to Timothy, to us today, is how do we handle that? Okay, number one, don't be conceited about that. We see our value, you know, we have a huge bank account, a huge retirement, that's our value, our worth. And he says, that's not it. But if you have it, you're to use it to share. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited, fix their hope on it, but on God. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, generous and ready to share. And by doing that, we're storing up for ourselves a good foundation, a good future, so we can take hold of that which is life indeed. Again, back to one point, I mean, there's something greater out there. It's that life indeed that we're trying to take hold of. But the things of this life get in the way. And we need to focus on it. So if there are instructions when we have more than what we need, what we're to do with that, and what our mindset is to be on. But what, as we're going to study in the parable after this, in Luke 8 and Matthew 13, the parable of the sower, one of the types of soil talks about the riches and cares of this world. What does it do to our spiritual life, he says in that parable?
Chokes.
It chokes it out. Our wealth can suffocate us. It can choke out our spiritual life. And that's a good place to stop. All right, so next week we're going to, again, dive into this parable, the parable of the rich man, and I want to look at it from this perspective. What was the condition of the rich man, you know, in the present? And how did he view his present circumstances? But then look at it, how did it turn out? Did how it turned out match what the present perception was? Okay? Because it oftentimes we go through life thinking, this is how my life's going to be, and then it doesn't turn out that way. So we will dive into that parable, Lord willing, next week.